Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events, and we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This was a special conversation. My guests are Jennifer Ocker and Naomi Bagdonis. Jennifer is the General Atlantic Professor of Marketing at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. She is widely published in leading scientific journals, and her work has been featured in The Economist, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic. She co-authored the award-winning book, The Dragonfly Effect, Quick, Effective, and Powerful Ways to Use Social Media to Drive Impact. And Naomi is a Stanford lecturer, strategy and media consultant, and a professionally trained comedian. She's designed and facilitated innovation workshops and strategy offsites for the boards and leadership teams of Fortune 100 companies. And she performs improv and sketch comedy in LA. They have a new book, and it's called Humor Seriously: Why Humor is a Secret Weapon in Business and Life. They're also dear, dear friends of my wife, Anne, and I. We're actually featured in this book, in the opening paragraph of this book. Good conversation. I think there's good information, and there's some really touching stories. So enjoy it.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Jennifer and Naomi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
It's such a delight to be here, Kelly.
All right, so we know each other. and I'm wondering, Jennifer, do you remember how we first got in touch or no?
I thought it was Adam Grant who connected
us. It was
us.
Adam Grant, yes.
Oh, we love Adam Grant. And we have also hired his 12-year-old daughter, Joanna, who is the most remarkable videographer, editor, and producer that we have met so far. So yeah, Joanna Grant.
She's creating a trailer for us. She's wildly talented and creative. And and way more fun than any adult we work with. So as the research suggests, she bears it out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the classic example of, you know, of Adam doing the thing he does, which is you wrote something on LinkedIn that I was interested in. And I happened to be in a conversation with him and he said he knew you and he would connect us. And then I guess that's a good way to switch into this conversation. Naomi, can you talk about how this book begins?
Oh, how the book begins.
Yeah. Because it's us. It's
the book begins. Oh, Kelly, your favorite story from the book about all of us, our favorite story as well. The book begins on a stage in Chicago, mm-hmm. and 10 behavioral scientists walk onto this stage to do something. And these are very impressive behavioral scientists who do research into things like decision making and cognition and AI. And so you would think, you know, it's sort of set up, you would think that they are there to do something very impressive and talk about something very lofty. And instead, the 10 of us were there to perform very poor sketch comedy with you and with Anne. So this was our really the kickoff to our journey, which was this research boondoggle where you invited us to the Second City. And we got a whole bunch of people in a room together who believe that humor is not just fun and games, but that it's one of the most profound and important things that we can work on and create more of in our lives and in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it was great fun and intellectually stimulating, and we all made friends, which is great. And Jennifer, I mean, you write in the book, quote, "The research to date couldn't be more clear. Humor has a profound impact on human psychology and behavior." And this is, I think, not a thing that people widely know.
Absolutely. I mean, there is such a significant return on investment in humor. You certainly see it firsthand at Second City in the mm-hmm. in the, you know, the culture that you create there. But what you know, businesses often don't know is how much it's underappreciated and how important it is. You know, we know things like when people use humor at work, and it doesn't even need to be good humor. It just has to be not inappropriate humor, that because the bar is so low. They are 23% more respected and seen as more competent and confident. So if you want to be respected, you need to like listen to this research. Furthermore, employees who rate their bosses as having a sense of humor, again, any sense of humor, they report to be 15% more satisfied and engaged in their jobs, and they rate their bosses as 27% more motivating and admired. And if you're not into being motivating or admired or having engaged employees, there's still a place of humor in your cold, cold heart. And that is about, you know, sort of the bottom line that, you know, using humor translates to actual, you know, increased levels of sales. There's one study that was done that showed that adding a simple, mildly funny line to the end of a sales pitch, just like, you know, my final offer is X and I'll throw in my pet frog, that increases customers' willingness to pay by 18%.
That's wild. I mean, is that some sort of priming effect? That sort of, do you think?
Oh, it's such a good question. Yes, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that when people laugh together, that that it changes not just psychologically the way you behave with someone, but neurologically as well. So there may be a priming effect that's at its core. But what we also find, and you know this better than anyone, is that it's much more, you know, physiological than it is just sort of psychological. That, you know, when you laugh together with someone, there's a healthy dose of a cocktail of very productive hormones that are released, like endorphins and oxytocin and dopamine. And so when that happens, people become more open, more trusting, et cetera. So I think there's multiple mechanisms at work.
Yeah.
You also mentioned this Gallup poll that showed the frequency with which we laugh or smile each day starts to plummet around the age of 23. Naomi, you're a young person. What? That seems crazy.
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm
22.
I'm sorry. How do we know that?
Yeah, I know. I'm so young. let me just convey.
I'll go on the record and say I'm the oldest person on this call.
Yeah, let me just convey what it's like to be so young. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So we find this horrifying research that shows, so this Gallup poll was really fun. It asked a really simple question, and that is, did you smile or laugh a lot yesterday? So everyone listening can think about their answer to that question. Did you smile or laugh a lot yesterday? And what we found was age 16, age 18, age 20, the answer is pretty consistently yes. And then at age 23, people fall off a cliff. So they start answering no, and they don't start answering yes again until they hit around 70. So what we know is happening is people go to work, and all of a sudden, they are very serious, they have important jobs. And most importantly, they think that they have to act a certain way to be successful. And that way that they think they have to act does not include their sense of humor. And of course, this is totally backwards, but this is what we are finding in the world.
I love that so much social science is fake it till you make it. Like, you know, the idea of, like, if you smile more, you're going to be happier. And, you know, it's like oh, this is the science of faking it till you make it.
Totally.
But it's not totally, right? Part of it is, you know, it's physiological and, mm-hmm. that you actually can see from brain science that there's a neurochemical shift when people laugh together, and that it has benefits, you know, on relationships as well. When people share, just remember a story of laughing together versus, you know, a story of, you know, being happy together. They're 23% more satisfied in their relationships. So here we're spending all of this time going to therapy. Not me and Andy, but everyone else. Whereas what you could just do is cultivate some more memories of laughing together, that belly joint laughing together. It's free and you don't have to go to therapy. So there's that.
And Kelly, another part of that, the idea of faking it till you make it, and this genuinely changing our brains and our behavior. So there was a study run where people were asked to write down three funny things at the end of each day. So just for a week, write down three funny things. Now, obviously, some of these people, if asked at the beginning, would probably say, I don't have a lot of joy. Nothing funny is happening to me today. But at the end of 7 days, what they find is people report having more joy and more moments in their lives. And they also did follow up with these people, and they found that these people reported lower rates of depression versus the control, lower rates of stress versus the control, and also increased perceptions of control in their lives. And so to your idea about the priming effect, right? We know from psychology that our brains are programmed to find what we set out to look for. Right. And so if we are looking for humor, if we're looking for moments of joy, then we will find more of them and create more of them in our lives as well.
That's funny. When last time I was on campus with you folks, I had a coffee with Tina Seelig. I don't know if you remember this, but Anne was saying, because she was working on something around luck. And I don't know if she's still at work on it, but she goes, oh, Kelly's completely lucky. He always finds a parking place. And she goes, I think what Kelly does is he assumes there's a parking place for him. And so he's finding it because he assumes it's actually there, which is a little bit around the same thing that you're talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I love that. All right. So you co-lead this class at Stanford, and you have your students complete a humor audit. Can you talk to our audience about that?
First of all, people believe that audits are not fun. This is the most fun audit. And all we do is just make our students that first week, you know, take note of how many times they laughed and when they laughed, mm-hmm. and how many times they made someone else laugh that week. And what's happening that first week is, A, they get super depressed. One of our students said, on Tuesday, I did not laugh once. This class is so depressing. And then two, more importantly, they start to understand where humor is missing in their life, and also when it does arise. And so they start to realize that looking for these opportunities to laugh, kind of like you looking for your parking spot, they start to expect to be delighted rather than disappointed. And so they kind of enter life for that first week being more on a precipice of a smile rather than a frown. And that simple level of awareness really helps to create this mindset shift.
And I imagine that instantly makes them take it seriously. Right. Because you and people don't. They don't realize
how. Yeah, when they realize they've lost all of this money because they forgot to toss in the pet frog, they're devastated. Yes. And then they're more devastated when they realize that there's, you know, that they have also gone off the humor cliff like the rest of the 23-year-olds. And that it benefits them, not just financially, not just from a leadership perspective, not just from a creativity perspective, which you have illuminated it so incredibly well in your own work, but it also from a health perspective, that people with a sense of humor live 8 years longer on average. And those are pretty funny years because of that, you know, sort of humor cliff. And they're 30% more resistant to severe disease. If that strikes, which at a moment in time when we're facing a global pandemic, means something, you know, very significantly.
Right. Yeah, let's talk about that too, because I there's a prescient passage in your book, which is, quote, at a time when remote work is on the rise, with digital modes of communication have all but replaced proverbial water cooler talk, finding ways to bond with our coworkers isn't easy. So that's a thing. And what I've discovered, and I'm curious about you, because are you teaching the class remotely now?
We are.
You are. Okay. So I find that I believe Zoom fatigue is real. I don't think that that's a lie. However, I also don't think people are finding that there actually are opportunities for joy in these experiences. And I'm curious what you think about that.
So people are not finding, or they are finding?
Well, we find it at Second City because we're a bunch of goofs. But, you know, when we talk to a bunch of our clients there, and this is why I think our virtual workshops are going so well, because like we have a musical director. So there's like a playlist that's happening, and then there's music to, you know, cover up awkward spots, and we carry ourselves with levity, and we have people kind of, you know, make fun of themselves and all that stuff. And I think that a lot of people approach these virtual environments in the most sober manner. And I think that's as much of a problem right now as anything. The mindset.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we are finding new and creative ways to laugh together over Zoom. And this is more important now than ever, because we know that the more technology mediated our communications become, the easier it is to lose our humanity and our sense of humor in the process, right? And part of that is we are being cued. I am looking at a computer. I have a keyboard in front of me. I am surrounded by technology and basically robots, right? And so it's easier for me to act like a robot and be really, really in efficiency mode rather than in human mode. What we're finding is there are a couple windows into people actually having more humor and more levity than they did before. The first is we are all in each other's living rooms, right? Or in my case, you're in my weird converted storage area because we just moved a week ago, right? So there's this, again, Kelly, to your point of priming effect, we are in locations where we're more comfortable being ourselves. We know that not only do people fall off a humor cliff when they hit 23, but there's this fork in the road where at home you're laughing a whole lot more, and during the weekdays you're laughing not at all. Mm-hmm. And so we're primed to laugh more. We're also finding people, you know, in leaders in particular, finding really creative ways to have laughter. So for example, I know one CEO who uses laugh tracks and cricket sounds. So he'll just have it queued up. He's got like this YouTube library of different sounds, and he'll just play them relentlessly. If he makes a joke and it doesn't go well, you know, he'll play the laugh track, or if he asks a question and it's quiet, he'll play the crickets. And we've just found all of these different hacks that people have, you know, having funny photos of themselves as their backgrounds, or, you know, so it is harder. It's also more important than ever. And there are more creative ways in to humor as well.
Jennifer, how are you handling this online all the time?
First of all, as a closet introvert, I'm one of the ones that actually quite enjoy it in many regards. But everything goes into waves, right? And so there was, for me personally, I went through a really low wave for the last week, especially yesterday. And it was interesting to think about the role of humor in that context, because you're so down, you're so alone. It's hard to think like, oh, you know, humor, just laugh at, you know, laugh at life or laugh at some small thing, these things that we really talk about the science of and the importance of, but it's hard when you're that low.
Right.
And one thing that I found is, you know, in our work on meaning versus happiness, is that one thing that's really important is that, when we prioritize happiness, and, you know, humor obviously, you know, is a close conceptual cousin to happiness. When we prioritize happiness, we often don't appreciate what's going around us. And what we find in our work is that when you anchor much more on meaning, you behave in ways that are more connected to others, and that ultimately leads to more happiness. But here's the really important difference between meaning and happiness. Meaning is experiencing anxiety and fear and anger. You know, that's part of life. And when you allow yourself to go low for a little while and have all of those negative emotions that I think we're all experiencing, you know, that makes us human and that makes us connect. What I think was really important, because I Naomi and I, one of the reasons we wrote our book and teach the class is that, you know, if you do anchor on meaning, it oftentimes, you know, can create, you know, a fair amount of, it can take a lot out of you. And what we find is when you anchor on meaning, but you're fueled by humor or levity, that's where you get mental well-being to increase. So it's like what you're doing, you might take very seriously, and it may be very hard. But when you don't take yourself so seriously, or when you can see a moment of humor or levity in the moment, it's that algorithm that's much more powerful for lasting happiness.
So this is really interesting because I had not thought about this equation before, but because when you think about happiness, you certainly understand like, oh, how humor or comedy would fit into that. However, as I think we've talked about this before, really cultivated good comedy is about truth. So, you know, and that is much more rooted in meaning. And I think maybe that especially for Anne's been using this term, I think it's from our friend Jen Ellison, about thin comedy, which would be like puns, and thick comedy being like Iannucci's work, you know, who does Veep and that sort of thing. Anything that's sort of brilliant comedy. So I wonder if that I this idea of truth, I think, is really important inside a lot of really great comedy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, the basics of it, as you know, teach in the class, you know, this idea of, you know, truth and misdirection. And if you can't absorb the truth of what's happening in our world, which, as you say, actually creates meaning, mm-hmm. then it's very hard to actually set up, you know, that misdirection. And in mm-hmm. fact, you know, Viktor Frankl, in A Search for Meaning, talks about the power of humor. He doesn't make this exact connection that you just made about truth, mm-hmm. but that when you know, are living a meaningful life, that actually can be a very much a source of humor, and that meaning can come out of humor itself as well.
So interesting. All right, I want to talk about status a little bit, because you write in the book, quote, "The more status and power you gain, the harder it is to stay calibrated." And mm-hmm. I thought about the best part. I didn't love Jerry Seinfeld's last stand-up special, but the absolute best part was when he said, "You know, I don't need to be up here," to the audience, which to me was a great way to deflate the status that we all know he has and being an incredibly wealthy person who doesn't need to be doing these specials. But talk to us a little bit about the research around status and humor and the perils, but then where it can work very well.
Yeah. So a couple things to know about the relationship between status and humor. First, as you rise in status, what is fair game to joke about shifts? And so we know that, you know, this concept of never punch down, right? Never make fun of someone, a group or any target that is of lower status than you. And of course, as you rise in status, that fair game zone shifts. And so we see people getting in trouble if they're, you know, a CEO. Think about this, right? Think about you're at a holiday party. And what happens, Kelly?
Yeah, someone drank.
Yeah. Okay. So people have been drinking. Actually, I think Kelly, I think we talked about this example with you, Anne, and Scott Dickers in the Second City, and it stuck with us so viscerally. And that is, you're at, and maybe you don't even remember this, but it was profound for us. You're at a holiday party. Everyone's been drinking, and think about the janitor making fun of the CEO. Then think about the CEO making fun of the janitor. Mm-hmm. Right. And it becomes viscerally apparent how status plays into humor. Yeah. The other thing is we know that humor or that laughter is very intertwined with status. And so there have been these wonderful studies done where they have people deliver lame jokes. And if you tell the audience that that person is in high status, the audience will laugh. And if you tell the audience that that is a low status person, they will not laugh. And so what this means is as we rise in status, as you said, it's really hard to stay calibrated because we don't know if people are laughing because we're funny or because we're the boss, which is part of the reason why we always tell the executives we work with to know who their set of trusted testers is. So who are the people that you trust that are going to come up to you and say, "Hey, Kelly, not so sure that that one was appropriate," or, you know, "Don't think your delivery was quite there," or, you know, basically give you real feedback.
you know, because of course, crafting comedy status becomes a very big thing to understand. Because, I mean, if you think of any famous comedy duo, there's one high status and one low status. And most of the comedy comes from the low status person turning tables on the high status person, of course.
Totally.
And then I think in particular with gender also plays into that in an interesting way. And a lot of the examples I do use when I talk about this is Tina Fey is a great example of this, is that so much of her work, she puts herself in the lower status position. But the high status people like, you know, an Alec Baldwin or Tracy Morgan, they're buffoons. They're clearly buffoons. But that she almost has to be in the lower status for that comedy to actually work.
Totally, totally. And also that when you are in that high status role, that's when self-deprecation gets really powerful. And so, you know, there's this misperception that, oh, if I make fun of myself, people will know my weaknesses. Actually, if you are confident enough as a high status person to be making fun of yourself, that's incredible. That can be incredibly power enhancing.
Yeah, yeah. You have one of the things that's nice about this book, too, is you offer sort of advice for people in terms of how they can, because I think, you know, people are very scared, as I can understand why, in terms of using comedy, especially when they think they're not funny. I mean, you know, I don't know if you know that Anne landed on the title of her next book was Funnier. And the reason she's calling it that is because parents would come up to her at Columbia College and say, are you going to make my daughter or son funny? She goes, I can't make them funny. I can make them funnier. So find out what is that they've got of comedy, and she can improve that through crafting and skilling and practice. You talk in the book about turning accidents into folklore. And I love this idea. And I wonder if you can expound on it for a little bit.
Part of this is recognizing and embracing mistakes when they happen. And so one example that we give in the book is the JibJab founders. So we talked to Greg Spiridellis from JibJab. And, you know, when they were first founding JibJab, they wanted to have all of their founding principles in huge banners on the wall, right? So those founding principles would stay with the organization forever. And one of those founding principles was agility. And so they printed this enormous banner, they put it up in their office, and then they realized that agility was spelled wrong. And so it was like agility or something. And it was this moment where they had a decision and they were like, okay, are we going to take that down, reprint it, you know, and keep and have the agility be perfect? Or are we going to recognize this moment as like, you know what? We move fast, we make mistakes, we're going to be agile, and we're not going to take ourselves too seriously along the way. And so that itself became a meta principle. So they kept this misspelled, you know, banner that says agility, and they kept it up in their office, and it became this sort of folklore of the organization that the banner was misprinted and the founders didn't take themselves too seriously to, you know, tear it down. And we hear this across all organizations that oftentimes humor comes not from the planned thing, the perfectly executed thing, but from that moment where something goes wrong and the decision is made to not take ourselves too seriously and laugh about it.
Yeah, and planning can be problematic. If there's too much planning, comedy doesn't work, and humor isn't visible to you. I love that. I have these sort of defining stories of myself and who I am that I will often incorporate into my talks. And one of them was I had my first band in grade school was called Satan, and we put up posters for one of the concerts we were doing, but I spelled it S-A-T-I-N. So it was all this like devil, you know, stuff, and then Satin. That I've got my own framing there. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you each for a yes and story. But before I do that, this is a long paragraph from the book, but I want to read it because I think it's beautiful. I think it's beautifully written, and I think it's beautifully thought out. And I want each of you to sort of talk about what it might mean to you. Quote, humor is a choice, one that requires you to watch carefully as your life is unfolding. Listen to those around you and be present in the moment. We are wired to reflect on our past and envision our future. Humor helps remind us that each day, as it unfolds, is our life by prompting us to search for hidden truths in each moment and to look at people and situations in a new light. Humor engenders presence. That's beautiful. So, I don't know. It seems like you're saying something, but you're also offering something to people that they maybe should consider.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I don't know if this would be a great yes and story, but I think it kind of fits, and it definitely relates to the quote you just picked out. You know, my mom has volunteered for hospice for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And so we as a family, you know, my two sisters, my dad and I, we would talk about these stories that she would share with us around the dinner table, what people wish for in their last days of life. And the, you know, the thing that's really interesting about that is the regrets that people mentioned, because it was my mom's job to see if she could, you know, talk about, tackle them, is, you know, falls around these five categories: boldness, authenticity, presence that you just pointed mm-hmm. out, joy, and love. And the big secret that Naomi and I have really been able to delve into, not just in the research, but even just interacting with you and Anne and knowing Nora and just like this incredible community around us, is the power of humor can help mitigate each of these regrets. So people often mention that they wish they were like less fearful of change and lived more boldly. But humor, you know, moves us through these negative emotions more nimbly, and it diffuses tension and allows us to take bigger and bolder risks. And people, you know, my mom would say, you know, mention that they wish that they had a courage to live a life more true to themselves and not the life that others expected. And, you know, we find that humor empowers us to share these parts of ourselves that are unconventional and authentic. And when we're finding joy, we care less about what people think and more about what we believe. And then there's this presence that you found to be pointed. And then joy, just wish I didn't take myself so seriously. I didn't chase happiness, but I cultivated it and just laughed more. And then love, I wish I had the chance to say I love you one more time. And we find that when humor exists, you know, love is not far behind. And there's few acts as easy and generous as sharing a laugh with someone. So this idea of being able to take my mom's hospice work, which maybe mm-hmm. people would typically feel is, you know, sad, and be able to sort of dive deeper into it and say, yes, and why is this happening, had a fundamental impact, certainly on my life and Naomi's and my work.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I told you this, but the day Nora died, a lot of the doctors came by to visit and say goodbye to her. A doctor walked in and Anne was getting coffee and he goes, "Oh, I really wanted to say this to both of you. And this is not something I would normally say at this time, but I think you'll understand. There were so many times I walked into this room and I was jealous." Mm. And it was like I can't tell you. It's interesting. I told this to a friend of mine who had it engraved on this compass that he just sent to me last week. But it was such a, I think it's very much what you were just talking about, recognizing that we laughed a lot. We had a lot of joy because it was so important for us to maintain meaning, because that's the only way we were actually going to make it through the worst thing ever. Mm. That's powerful.
Mm. Mm. Well, I was going to share a different yes and story, but now I'm going to share this one. Okay. So my grandmother, when she was young, when she was in her late teens, she found a quote and she loved it so much that she found someone with a typewriter and she asked them to type it out on the typewriter so that she could hold it around in her purse with her. And she passed away when she was 97 and she had this typewritten note in a Ziploc bag in her purse still then. And the quote says, "Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life." And so I now have that quote framed. So I'm going to share a story from my grandmother. And this story is the story that my grandfather used to tell about why he decided to marry her, why he decided, "I want to marry this woman." So my grandma and my grandpa met because they were set up together and they were at this party that my grandpa's sister arranged. He was like, "Alice and Nate, you have to meet each other." So they're at this party and Nate hasn't talked to Alice yet. He's sort of looking at her across the room and something happened, which was Alice was talking to a good friend of hers and someone spilled red wine on her white dress. Mm-hmm. Now, my grandmother was very poor growing up. And she and her sister Rose had one dress that their mom had sewn that they shared. It was too big for Alice and it was too small for Rose, but they both wore it. And so this red wine spilled on this white dress. And my grandmother looked at it and she looked up and she said, "Well, that's a nice new pattern." And she dipped her hands in the wine and she sprayed it on the dress. to make more marks of wine. And my grandfather saw that from, you know, from 10 feet away. And he said, I'm going to marry that woman. And so it's folklore in our family. Talk about turning mistakes into folklore. So that yes and moment is why I'm here, really.
I am going to go on the record and say these are two of the best yes and stories that have ever ended the podcast. So thank you both. The book is called Humor Seriously, Why Humor is a Secret Weapon in Business and Life. Jennifer and Naomi, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
We're so grateful. We love you.
Love you too.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.